You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology Spotlight podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Hi, my name is Ros Benson. I'm a rheumatology trainee in Liverpool. I'm delighted today to be talking to Vanessa Quick. Vanessa is a consultant rheumatologist at Luton and Dunstable University Hospital, and she's an expert in giant cell arteritis. She has a particular interest in vascular ultrasound and the development of the giant cell arteritis fast track pathway. In today's podcast, we're going to be chatting around some of the more tricky diagnostic and management issues that relate to giant cell arteritis. So, Vanessa, the first part of our discussion today is going to be a bit about the role of ultrasound in management, pretest probability and the fast track pathway. So it's quite a lot of big areas to cover, but we'll do our best. So working in rheumatology that we both do, we know that we get lots of referrals for patients who might have GCA. And in the new BSR guidance, and we've referenced this in the recent e-learning case on Spotlight and GCA, there's a really good algorithm weighing up investigation findings against a patient's pretest probability. I just wondered, is this an approach you use in your clinical practice? And if so, could you talk us through how you stratify patients as to low, medium or high risk in regards to their pretest probability?
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Ros. It's a pleasure. This is a big question.
Yes.
And the short answer is that there is no clear and easy way of stratifying people into low, moderate and high probability of GCA. There are ways of classifying GCA. We all know the ACR criteria. They're quite old fashioned now, from 2010. And they have a high sensitivity for cranial GCA, but very low specificity. So you pick up lots of people that don't have the disease if you use that. There are more recent published ways of potentially defining people as GCA according to clinical criteria. For example, Bascard Ascriptus Group in Southend have created a GCA probability score. We do use that in our practice. And it is helpful for screening out low probability patients. But it is tricky to use it definitively to rule in patients without any other diagnostic tests, because, as you know, many of the symptoms and signs in GCA are very nonspecific. Things like headache, achy shoulders, stiffness, constitutional upset are things that GPs and general physicians will see much more commonly in other conditions like infection, other autoimmune disease or things like malignancy. So it is at times quite challenging. When GCA is obvious, when people have cranial symptoms such as ischemic symptoms, double vision, amaurosis fugax, jaw claudication, a really abnormal temporal artery on palpation, then it becomes more obvious. It's that big chunk of patients in the middle that are very challenging to diagnose. And there is an element of experience. And I think as rheumatologists, we are better placed than many specialists to help weed out the low probability cases, because a lot of GCA mimics are things that we see, things like inflammatory arthritis, osteoarthritis, TMJ discomfort, are things that we might be able to recognize that others don't. I think we're also better historians, and we often delve into the history because we don't have a single test for many of our conditions. But the short answer is that it is quite challenging does take a little bit of practice. And we know that if you look at cohorts of patients sent for biopsy, if a rheumatologist does it, then we're much better at peeling away those low probability patients and limiting biopsies. Hence, if we move on to fast track pathways, why many of the reported fast track pathways, and certainly ours in Luton, is run by rheumatology.
That's really useful. I think we all know the long-term side effects that steroids have for these patients. And if we make a diagnosis which isn't well evidenced and there's toxicity for the patient as a result, it really has often significant consequences. So it's so crucial, isn't it, for us to clinch a diagnosis as early on as we can, I think. I think probably that's one of the really useful things with ultrasound being a non-invasive test, which can now be preferentially often used prior to a temporal artery biopsy. That's much better for patients, isn't it? And what we expose them to in terms of investigation. I know that you use a lot of vascular ultrasound in your practice. Do you... We talk a lot about temporal artery ultrasound. Do you think we should all be doing axillary artery ultrasound alongside this?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So yes, temporal artery ultrasound is the key test, and most of the published evidence that you will read is focused around temporal artery ultrasound. And there was a recent meta-analysis done for the European College, the EULAR College guidance for large vessel imaging. That showed a high sensitivity of nearly 80% and a very high specificity of well over 90% in for temporal artery ultrasound. But you're right, adding in axillary artery ultrasound does increase sensitivity because GCA is not just a cranial disease. We know from imaging studies that over 80% of people with GCA will have large vessel involvement. And axillary artery ultrasound will pick up a percentage of those patients. If you compare PET, which is also used for the diagnosis of large vessel vasculitis and GCA, if you compare patients who are PET positive at the axillaries, 75% of them will have thickening of the temporal of the axillary artery on ultrasound. Right. So 3 out of 4 PET positive patients with axillary artery involvement will be positive on ultrasound. And ultrasound's much cheaper. It's much more highly available. Any vascular technician will be able to give you an axillary artery ultrasound. And it's actually much easier to do than temporal artery ultrasound. So if you're starting out as a scanner, and many rheumatologists might be trying to do that, you'll get good axillary images well before you can get good temporal images.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and you also, it's also less sensitive to steroids. So we know that a significant proportion of temporal positive patients on ultrasound will be negative within a few days. In fact, maybe as much as 50% by the end of 1 week. So you've got to move swiftly. Whereas axillary artery ultrasound, axillary artery thickening disappears much more slowly, and in some people never. So you have longer, and if you're setting up your pathway and you've not got all those rapid access slots, or you've not got enough rheumatologists to do those rapid access slots within 1 or 2 days or 3 days of seeing a patient, you might find that your axillary artery ultrasound component picks up patients at a later date who may have been both temporal and axillary artery positive, but are only axillary artery positive after, say, a week or two of steroids. And it's quick. Once you've got to get the patient undressed or wearing a shirt so you can access the armpits to scan the artery, but it takes about 30 seconds per side once you get good at it. So it doesn't add much time to the scan. So it is useful. The other thing is that the machine used for axillary doesn't necessarily have to be quite so high grade or expensive. So the machine that a department might have for MSK ultrasound and the probe they have to look at the wrist and the metacarpophalangeal joints will be more than enough to look at the axillary, but it probably won't be enough to look at the temporals unless they've got a hockey stick probe. So you don't need to change the kit that you have either. So in some centres, it can increase sensitivity by 20%. In specialist units where they can see patients quickly, they've got high-end kit and very experienced technicians, less so, maybe only a few percent. But for most people in the UK starting out, I definitely suggest, well, in everybody, I definitely suggest adding it in, because when it's there, it suggests large vessel involvement. And we know that if you've got large vessel involvement in GCA, patients tend to need a bit more steroid. They're a bit more refractory to treatment. They may need additional steroid-sparing agents. And now we have guidance if when we're using tocilizumab. Over the pandemic, we can extend use of tocilizumab in those with large vessel disease. So it will make a difference to treatment options.
Well, that's really interesting. Do you find that you see most people, if they do have evidence of extracranial GCA within their axillary arteries, that they'll both be bilaterally positive, or is that, or are some just unilateral, and does that correspond with the side of headache that they might be having?
So it doesn't correspond with the side of headache. That's definite. I can say that from my own practice. And it can be unilateral. If you imagine this disease is often one where the large vessel involvement is from the aorta or extending up into the cranial branches, so up into the aorta, into the subclavians, they then go out and change into the axillaries and then down into the brachial arteries down the arm. So you might, on large vessel imaging like PET, see subclavian artery involvement extending a little bit into the axillaries on one side and not on the other. And that will be reflected on your ultrasound. If a patient can really abduct their shoulder, and if a patient is nice and slim, then you can scan right up into their armpit, and you can then ask them to put their arm down and scan further into their subclavian. You may see, if you're able to go more proximally, the beginning of that smooth hypoechoic intermediate thickening known as the halo sign. And that change from thin wall to fatter wall in a sort of slope or taper-like function is absolutely typical of GCA. And if that point happens in the subclavian, then you won't see it on the axillary. But it is often bilateral, but definitely not always. And the tricky thing with the axillary arteries is that they are more prone to atherosclerosis than the temporal artery. So if you've got a bit of unilateral thickening, is that just a bit of atherosclerosis? So you have to treat that with a pinch of salt. And I tend to follow that up as high as I can to see if it's sort of slims back down again. Could that be, or, and has a more craggy and a more white texture to it, suggesting atherosclerosis rather than vasculitis.
That's really interesting. So I guess the challenge is for some of our patients that we get inconclusive reports when if we're not the rheumatologist doing the ultrasound, it might come back from our vascular ultrasonographers saying, yes, inconclusive. And then the question is, what do we do with that result? And do we go on, how do we go on to make or refute a diagnosis in that patient? What do you tend to do? Do you use PET CT as a next step, or then do you go on to try and think about a temporal artery biopsy?
So this is true in any test, isn't it? You can get a low positive ANA and wonder what to do with that. You can get borderline clinical findings as well. And that's absolutely true for GCA as well. If it's not absolutely definitive, the halo thickening in the context of an appropriate history, then yes, you do need to do a second test. And that test will really depend on the clinical presentation. So if someone's got typical cranial symptoms, symptoms above the neck, so headache, scalp tenderness, visual symptoms suggestive of GCA, such as unilateral blurring or amaurosis or double vision or dual claudication, that's a temporal artery biopsy. But if they are presenting more like a large vessel patient with no cranial symptoms, constitutional upset, fever, weight loss, and high acute phase response, then you may not say, well, I could still do a biopsy and the biopsy may still be positive, but the yield will be lower. Yep. So I'm going to go for large vessel imaging in that patient. And if you have access to CT PET, then that is a fantastic test, particularly pre-steroids. But even a CT CAP is going to be useful, because in a patient like that, there is a wide differential, isn't there? You're thinking about cancer, you're thinking about a deep infection, and the CT is going to help you with that. You may also see the rind of intermediate thickening on the large vessels on CT, and that's called a donut sign. quite nicely rather than a halo sign. And if it, we're off topic slightly, but if that happens in Takayasu's, that's called a macaroni sign. So absolutely, it really depends on what you have access to and the presentation. And there are times when I do both a biopsy and large vessel imaging. In fact, quite frequently, actually. But a PET is nearly £900, and many people won't have access easily to that quickly. And the problem with PET, like ultrasound, and perhaps even more so than ultrasound, is that it's very sensitive to steroids. So after 3 days, you're going to lose sensitivity. And by 10 days, two-thirds of patients who were PET positive will no longer be PET positive. So that's an expensive test where the patient may need to travel to a different center that after 10 days isn't really going to help you in a significant proportion of patients. The specificity will stay high. So if you're still worried, it's still a useful test. But you have to be a bit careful with these tests and how you use them.
I guess this question about the effect of steroids on the sensitivities of these investigations just highlights the need for a really effective fast track pathway. And I know within this is there's different iterations with all different trusts across the UK, and it's been very clear in the BSR GCA 2020 guidance that if there's visual symptoms, somebody should be seen within 21 working day by ophthalmology, and then ideally within 1 to 3 working days by a rheumatologist. It's obviously quite tricky to instigate this within our practice because we're all very busy, but you've had a very successful pathway that you've developed in your trust, and I wondered if you could just briefly talk us through how you think or what are the key factors to designing a well-functioning GCA pathway.
Gosh, big question. So you do need rapid access, but certainly it is possible to set up a pathway with one clinician running it. It doesn't have, it will have capacity and sustainability issues, but if you've got one enthusiastic clinician who wants to start the process, then that's great. I was able to do that on my own because I have enough rheumatology colleagues who support me with the other aspects of our service. So there is a critical number of rheumatologists, but you may be able to see triage patients over the phone to decide whether imaging might be appropriate or not. And you may, in your particular hospital, rely on other specialists to help you. It doesn't have to be a rheumatologist, although that would, I think, is preferable. And then you need rapid access if you're running an ultrasound-driven pathway to ultrasound. But again, that doesn't need to be done by a rheumatologist if you don't have those expertise. There are really fantastic high-functioning pathways with really rapid access to ultrasound where the service is run by their vascular technicians. Most trusts will have a TIA pathway where their vascular technicians will do carotid Dopplers within 24 hours. And that service will often have capacity to scan a few additional patients for a GCA service per week. They will need additional training and they will need an additional probe, a higher sensitivity probe for their machine in most cases. But many vascular technicians are keen and interested to learn. So it's knowing what services you have in your trust and harnessing them. You can also work on improving your temporal artery biopsy service by liaising with whoever does that. In our trust, it's MaxFax. And they provide us with a fantastic service where they can provide a biopsy for us. They did an audit in the last few years. Their mean was 2.4 days. So they really, it can be done. We're a medium-sized district general hospital. And we work together very much as a team trying to do that. And then you've got to be able to see your patient quickly with those results so that you can bring them off steroids if they don't have GCA. But that could potentially be done as a telephone appointment as well in the post-COVID era. These things don't, you don't necessarily need to see the patient. And you could also potentially involve your specialist nurses with that kind of discussion. So it doesn't have to be the doctor ringing. So, and in terms of when you're actually diagnosing GCA, following that patient up, a lot of the care is around the comorbidities that come with long-term high-dose steroids, things like osteoporosis management, management of mood, looking out for diabetes and high blood pressure. And you can share that with the GP, but our nurses also support me in monitoring and managing patients over their, you know, 2, 3 or longer years that they're under the service.
Your final point brings us on really nicely to the next thing that I wanted to discuss today in our podcast, which is the role of tocilizumab in giant cell arteritis. So for any of the listeners who have done the e-learning case, they'll see that our patient, Mrs. Thorne, had significant problems with using the high-dose steroids that were required to keep her giant cell arteritis in remission. And like many of our patients, they have significant comorbidities and she was having hyperglycemic episodes. So what's been brilliant about the advent of tocilizumab is that we've got another option for our patients, which we didn't have before this. I'm really interested to sort of see with your experience, because we're all getting used to how we use this in clinical practice, how you find patients are at the end of the 12 months of funding for treatment with tocilizumab. Do you find that most of them have a sustainable remission, or are you finding that they need to continue on with steroids, albeit a lower dose? Or are you starting to use other disease modifying agents like methotrexate?
Great question. So there are a number of issues here. So every individual rheumatologist across the country, particularly in England, even in centres that use a lot of tocilizumab, are not going to have more than 20 to 30 patient experience unless they were involved with the clinical trials or were using it before NHS England approval. And the other thing is that we've been allowed to extend use of tocilizumab in patients who are coming to the end of their treatment this year because of the pandemic. So actually we have less, as a result of the pandemic, we have less experience than perhaps we would have done of people coming off tocilizumab, to answer that question. I think we have to first look at the evidence that's been published from clinical trials. And we know from GIACTA and one other trial that whilst tocilizumab does work really well for a year, it's great at providing a sustained remission, reducing flares, and significantly reducing cumulative prednisolone dose. But if you stop it after a year, about 50% of people flare. Many of those are within the first 6 months of stopping, which is why we've been allowed to extend treatment over the pandemic. There is a little bit of evidence that from largely retrospective cohort studies that if you extend treatment for longer, and if you taper the dose, so you increase the frequency, or increase the time span between injections, that you can reduce that flare rate quite substantially. But we don't have capacity to do that in England yet. And this is low quality evidence. But we do have some evidence that patients with certain types of GCA, particularly those with large vessel GCA, are in a higher risk group of flaring. So those kinds of patients, I've been more nervous about bringing off steroids, particularly over the pandemic. But the other end of the spectrum, there are patients pre-tocilizumab who've done extremely well and been able to come down and off steroids with few flares and need only 12 to 18 months of treatment. So there is a rationale for trying to bring people off treatment. And perhaps once the COVID era is over, we'll start to do that. Perhaps this is an opportunity now for us to cautiously start withdrawing treatment in patients, and perhaps by reducing the frequency of injections to fortnightly. But really, this is a field where research is really desperately required, because we don't know the answer yet. A lot of patients that I have had also been on steroids for quite some time before tocilizumab was added in. And bringing people off steroids, if they've been on them a long time, can be tricky because of adrenal suppression. So they may have quiet GCA, but they still find it tricky to come off the steroid because of that reason. And so I do still have patients on tocilizumab, but also on a bit of steroid. And it's going to take a long time to bring them down and off treatment. So I don't know. I think we are working as a community to answer those questions.
Yeah. And I guess what also is very difficult is as we start to wean the steroids down or we space out the tocilizumab, trying to assess our patients as to whether or not they're having a relapse of disease. And with the nature of how tocilizumab works, it's an IL-6 inhibitor and its effect on ESR and CRP, how we would use inflammatory markers as a guide to see whether or not somebody is having a flare-up of disease, that is harder in people on TOC. Do you find that in these situations you just end up being driven entirely by patients' symptoms and clinical features, or is there a role for imaging in this sort of situation?
So again, we don't really know the answer to this, and this is an area of active research at the moment for ultrasound in the UK and also PET. But certainly you need to rely on symptoms, and as you say, you can't really rely on the CRP, which will be suppressed in a patient on tocilizumab. But I do find in my clinical practice that ultrasound is very useful. I had a patient only a couple of days ago who was diagnosed with GCA some years ago now. And it was a clinical diagnosis because it was before we started our fast track pathway. So she was diagnosed in primary care, treated for some weeks on steroids. And by the time she got into secondary care and had her biopsy, it was negative. But the symptoms were very suggestive, and she very slowly reduced the dose over a period of a few years and came off steroid about 2 years ago, and then re-presented with polymyalgic symptoms, headache, and vague left-sided jaw pain on chewing, jaw claudication. And I know her ultrasound had been completely normal 2 years ago because I'd scanned her, and it was definitely abnormal with an obvious halo at both temporal arteries and at the left facial artery, which we haven't talked about, but that's a nice artery to scan. It probably doesn't increase sensitivity in the population as a whole, but it can be useful in isolated cases. And her left facial artery, the side of her jaw pain, was a beautiful halo, no halo on the right. So I'm very comfortable that she has GCA now, and she's almost certainly had GCA all along, and this is a relapse. Now, of course, she's not on tocilizumab at the moment, but that's a key, that gives us an idea about how these changes change over time and do seem to correspond to disease activity, and therefore may well be particularly useful in this cohort of patients where we don't have that acute phase response to rely on. And I routinely will scan patients at the end of their year of tocilizumab, and in a significant proportion, I will also order a PET scan, because if they're all quiet and normal, that gives me confidence to think about withdrawing treatment. And then if they flare again on extended treatment or reduced dosing, and the imaging has come positive again, that's a very powerful signal that their disease is active. But this is personal experience and retrospective case report evidence rather than clinical trial evidence that needs to be done prospectively.
That's really interesting. Thank you. And I guess we've talked quite a bit about tocilizumab in the refractory patient or the patient who is unable to have steroids because of side effects. There seems to be very little evidence that I can see for tocilizumab to be used in the acute phase of the disease. So we recently had a patient with temporal artery ultrasound proven giant cell arteritis and unilateral site loss. And despite having pulsed IV methylpred given very timely and a significant improvement in their inflammatory markers, they went on to develop bilateral site loss, which is devastating for an individual. And I wondered if there's any role for the use of tocilizumab in this sort of situation acutely.
So the short answer is there is no clear evidence base for this. The clinical trials of tocilizumab are to maintain sustained remission rather than to treat the acute phase. But certainly I've had, I think, three patients with site-threatening refractory GCA with ongoing ischemic symptoms, particularly amaurosis fujax, alternating in both eyes. And after weeks of high-dose steroids, more than a milligram per kilogram doses of steroids, and repeated pulse steroids, one of the patients had two lots of three pulses of methylprednisolone and was still getting alternating amaurosis fujax. And in those patients, they were given IV rather than subcut, IV tocilizumab. And in my limited experience of those three cases, they all did very well. And the symptoms did settle very quickly. We've published on this, and there are other case reports of benefit. And certainly in places where you can give tocilizumab in all patients, not just those with refractory or relapsing disease, then there is a strong recommendation to give tocilizumab in patients like yours with ischemic symptoms at the outset. But I think it's a tricky one, and each patient will need to be taken on an individual basis and discussed with your MDT to decide whether that patient can be defined as refractory disease. Do you define it as refractory after a day of treatment or 2 weeks of treatment? I think it must be done on an individual basis. The rationale for IV over subcut in that context is theoretical, really. So to reach a steady state of tocilizumab, if you use IV, it takes 6 hours. If you use subcut, it takes 3 days. And that's from evidence from RA trials, the pharmacokinetic sub-studies of tocilizumab in RA. But it just sort of makes sense, really, that it might be effective. We need some more evidence. We need some clinical trials.
Well, that's really helpful. One final question that I've got, if that's okay, is I'm very interested in the new giant cell arteritis GCA guidance from the BSR in 2020, that chest x-rays now are no longer mandated as part of the patient's initial workup. Now, I think probably quite often we'll find a patient will have had one fairly recently, but I just wonder, how is this altering, or is it altering your practice? And are there particular patients that you might think about doing it at baseline? Because of course a wider mediastinum might give you a bit of a hint to do some further aortic imaging, thinking, is there some aortitis here, some extracranial involvement?
Yeah, I mean, I think you may be doing a chest x-ray for more than just the GCA indication in this population. So often you might be wanting to rule out an infection that might be driving some of their non-specific symptoms. Or perhaps you might be considering a drug like methotrexate, where you would do a baseline chest x-ray anyway. So I have to say I do a chest x-ray in many patients, but yes, the reason the guidelines don't recommend it is that there's no real evidence this is a useful way of monitoring for aortic aneurysm. The problem is that we don't really know who we should monitor. GCA, if you know they've had large vessel involvement on imaging, we know that that can increase risk of aortic aneurysm, but so can being male, being a smoker, having hypertension or cardiovascular disease. All these things go together. So whether you're going to do monitoring in the form of a chest x-ray that's insensitive or something else like an echo or a large vessel imaging will again depend on an individual patient by patient assessment. And if you're going to do that, then you need a baseline in theory. And so that's the chest x-ray to look back on, but it is a very blunt tool for assessing for aortic aneurysm.
So that's really helpful, and probably in the reality, as you've said, we all end up doing them in most of our patients, but it's having this high index of suspicion that some people do go on to develop extracranial disease, I guess, isn't it? So
yeah,
I think increasingly it's becoming more and more obvious that there seem to be different phenotypes of GCA, and trying to work out how, what sort of patient we have sitting in front of us, how their disease is going to affect them is going to be important as to thinking about their future treatment, and I imagine.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. I think that's, I mean, really helpful, and has discussed and explained a lot of the nuances that we're seeing in GCA as time goes on. And I think just highlights how many more areas there are for active research, and we need studies to be able to help guide our management decisions, don't we, and our diagnostic choices. So, but
we're absolutely
in a different place to what we were probably 10, 15 years ago, though, which is what's exciting. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank you for having given me the opportunity to chat with you today. That was great.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology Spotlight, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.